Any attack on the United States or on our allies will be defeated.
The U.S. Defense Secretary reassures protection for South Korea and Japan. It's Monday, February 6th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Vietnam evolves its trade policy. Can China's two-child policy help its future? Women students seek to excel in Silicon Valley. And the Super Bowl, as seen in China. It kicks off right now on VOA Asia. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis emphasized America's commitment to support its allies in Asia against the growing North Korean nuclear threat during his visit to South Korea this past week, while sidestepping the divisive issue of defense-sharing costs.
Any attack on the United States or on our allies will be defeated, and any use of nuclear weapons would be met with a response that would be effective and overwhelming.
Mattis and his counterpart, South Korean Defense Minister Han Min-koo, met privately Friday in Seoul and made brief statements to the press at the conclusion of their talks. He says Secretary Mattis's visit to South Korea and the meeting show our determined will to respond to North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, and this will be the strongest warning to North Korea. President Donald Trump's defense secretary made Northeast Asia his first overseas trip to stress the importance of maintaining the long-standing U.S. alliances with South Korea and Japan and to reaffirm the U.S. commitment to provide extended deterrence that guaranteed the United States Armed Forces would help counter any North Korean attack on its allies. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has made clear his government's ambition to achieve a credible nuclear deterrence and be accepted into the international community as a nuclear state. Increasing international sanctions have failed to deter Pyongyang from intensifying its development efforts with two nuclear tests and 24 missile launches in the last year. During his New Year's message, Kim Jong-un said his country was prepared to openly test an intercontinental ballistic missile that has the potential to reach the U.S. mainland. During the presidential campaign, Donald Trump suggested he might withdraw troops and allow allies to procure their own nuclear weapons to defend themselves unless they agree to pay significantly more for American protection. And in his inaugural address, the president vowed to change U.S. policies that, quote, subsidize the armies of other countries while allowing for the very sad depletion of our military. However, President Trump has indicated that he holds in high regard the views and counsel of his defense secretary, who is a retired Marine Corps general and decorated war veteran. Mattis's visit to South Korea and Japan and his strong support for regional U.S. alliances has reassured many that he will uphold the United States military commitment. Ko Ming-hyun is a researcher at the Asian Institute in Seoul. According to what Secretary Mattis said in his hearings and his comments in the past, he is a person who belongs to the typical alliance faction that has a traditional view on security. Even if a contentious dispute arises over defense costs, regional security analyst Daniel Pinkston with Troy University in Seoul said he expects future negotiations over the defense-sharing cost agreement to be handled over time and in a non-disruptive way.
As far as tearing that up right now or restarting negotiations on that right now or approaching it in some way that's going to totally blow up the alliance relationship and things that have already been negotiated and planned and military exercise cycles and all of those things, that's not going to happen.
The U.S. Defense Secretary and the South Korean Defense Minister this week also voiced support for deploying the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense U.S. missile system in South Korea later this year. Mattis said its sole purpose is to defend against a North Korean attack. China objects to THAAD on the basis that its powerful radar can be used to monitor other countries in the region and that the advanced weapons system will further destabilize the regional security balance. We invite you to read more on our top story by following VOA Asia on Facebook and visiting our voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Police chief runs investigation of Myanmar's lawyer's killing. Avalanche kills 45 in eastern Afghanistan. State elections test popularity of India's Modi. Pakistani officials signal flexibility in discussing Afridi case with the United States. WeChat users send 46 billion digital red packets for Lunar New Year. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Since President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from participating in the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, many smaller Asian countries are working on ways to boost their regional trade. VOA Vietnamese reporter Tra My joins me with how Vietnam is coping with the development.
Most recently, I spoke to two economists about what Vietnam should do with the TPP minus U.S. Vietnam itself has not officially claimed any steps to be taken yet. Everything is still in speculation. Those economists that I have spoken to include economist Nguyễn Xuân Nghĩa. He's a well-known economist plus a well-known columnist for a couple of radio and TV stations in California. The other one is Vũ Quang Việt. He's a renowned economist, and he used to be a statistic expert for the United Nations. They came out saying that now without U.S., it's not a total collapse yet. There's still hope for Vietnam. They said now that the U.S. is stepping away, China is trying to step their foot in to fill in the gap.
China does have the world's second largest economy, but it's a different type of economy than what they would have been dealing with the United States. China is mainly an exporter, and its internal markets are pretty well controlled by the government.
With the subsidies and stuff like that.
And so it's very difficult for even American businesses to get in, I would think, much less, you know, countries
plus
like Vietnam.
Their currency policy. So it's not 100% sure that you can have a fair playground with them. So everybody is cautious about that. They're trying to fill in with RCEP, another trade deal, and FTAA. Another trade deal that they have been initiating so far. And they have expressed their willingness in doing so, in pioneering free trade globally. But those economists say that China has no credibility as a global pioneer in those fields yet. They have to build up their own credibility and good names in the field before they can think of filling in the gap, because not only Vietnam but also many other countries, they have been well aware that playing with China is a, how do you say, can be backfire. It's like a two-edged sword.
Right.
Yeah, because most of the time they would import their low quality products into your country, you know, to get a good name, and then they export that out or other markets with other names and things like that. So Vietnam needs to be, Vũ Quang Việt told me that Vietnam needs to be really careful when thinking about, without U.S., can I play with China? Can I go with the RCEP deal or not? Mm-hmm. So what Vietnam should do now, according to Nguyễn Xuân Nghĩa, is Vietnam has to reform itself, reform its economy to have an open market, a more competitive market, so that without the U.S. or without China, they can be independent on their own and step away from being so dependent on any other power.
Yeah, it's not as if the United States is not seeking any trade in Asia. Obviously, the United States has a lot of trade throughout the region. But under President Donald Trump, the idea is that rather than have these big free trade agreements, do these bilateral deals.
Yeah.
And so perhaps a tailored trade deal with Vietnam will actually benefit Vietnam.
Yes, but remember one thing, you know, with the U.S., you know, when you want to play with me, when you want to be in the same playground with me, you have to be a fair player first. You have to respect your people's rights and labor rights and intellectual properties rights first in order to be a fair player.
A lot of developments to come in trade in Asia. Tra My from our Vietnamese service, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Happening now in Asia, Uber is suspending its service in Taiwan after being hit with millions of dollars in fines by the government. Taiwan officials consider Uber's business on the island to be illegal. They say the U.S. startup only has permission to operate as a tech company, not to provide transportation services. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happier with us today on VOA Asia. In 2016, the number of births in China increased following its landmark decision to end the country's controversial one-child policy and allow parents to have two children. And while nearly half of the 17.86 million births last year were second children, the increase was much smaller than officials and experts had expected. VOA's Bill Ide went to the streets of Beijing to learn more about the policy's impact during the Lunar New Year holiday as families get together.
Hohai Lake in central Beijing is a popular place for families to have fun during the holidays. And on a cold winter day, a good place to gauge how the public is warming up to the new two-child policy. Many we spoke with already had a second child or wanted to have another, but the cost of raising a child in China is a big obstacle for many. One man, surnamed Liu, says he and his wife considered having a second child, but felt the burden was too much to bear. Families in China spend as much as $1,000 to $2,000 each month on extracurricular classes.
Wish we could have a second child. One child on his own is too lonely. It would be better to have two children.
Education and activities are not the only expenses, says James King.
Of course, there's also travel overseas, which is very expensive. We try to travel at least once a year.
James and his wife Lucy, who have a second child, say the benefits outweigh the cost, but add that each family situation is different.
In the future, a child must deal with four elderly parents, but having a brother or sister can make it easier to divide up those responsibilities.
Despite its massive population, China faces a growing demographic problem, aging. Its working population is shrinking as the number of pensioners increases rapidly. Starting next year, there is likely to be a persistent decrease in the number of children being born, experts say, as the number of women eligible to have a second child will begin to shrink as more fill their quota. For some, even having children is questionable. Bai, a young single man who works in the hotel industry in Beijing, has two older sisters.
Life is very stressful, but if I was to have a child, one would be enough. Either a boy or girl would be fine.
Like many of its Asian neighbors, China has a low fertility rate. And so far, the government has offered few incentives to encourage more births, aside from ending its one-child policy. And because of that, some critics say the policy shift may be too little too late. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Japan's Vice Finance Minister Matsusuga Asakawa says his nation doesn't understand what Donald Trump is talking about after the new U.S. president accused Japan of devaluing its currency. Trump has also targeted the country's auto industry, with top carmaker Toyota singled out. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, women in high-tech industries and at American universities make up just one in six students of computer science. That's changing on some campuses, as Mike O'Sullivan reports from Harvey Mudd College near Los Angeles, where, like Jane Wu, more than half of last year's graduates in computer science were women.
Robots that demonstrate Chinese Tai Chi and breakthroughs in artificial intelligence have drawn students like Jane Wu into computer science.
I think the moment for me was during my freshman robotics elective that I took called Autonomous Vehicles. And in that class, we got to make our own autonomous robots from scratch.
Harvey Mudd College, with just 800 students, is part of an educational cluster called the Claremont Colleges, and it stresses engineering. It is also a leader in breaking down barriers to women in computer science, which started for one student with an introductory class in computer coding.
It was a very balanced class, and I think the professors also do a very good job of making sure everyone feels welcome regardless of their coding ability.
Women were pioneers in the early days of computers when Grace Hopper, who was later a U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, helped invent programming languages.
So she is the original coder. And I think it was only kind of in later decades, 80s and 90s, that computer games and kind of the idea of computer programming kind of got heavily marketed towards boys rather than girls.
Now many young women are rediscovering programming.
With coding, I can just have my computer, have some programming language I'm working in, and I can make almost whatever I want.
Internships in industry are part of the training. Student Samantha Andow is heading to Microsoft this summer.
I'm really excited to see all the problems that computer science is working on right now.
Without the best and the brightest on the keyboards, regardless of gender,
we're not going to get as good solutions and as much progress as we need on the problems facing the world, whether it's climate change or education, healthcare.
Mudd College President Maria Clave says today's problems require the creativity that diversity brings. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Claremont, California.
Developing at this hour in Asia, a potential change to American immigration rules has set off a panic in India's tech industry. Major Indian tech stocks sank last week on reports President Trump wants to change the H-1B visa program, allowing skilled foreigners to work in the United States. The tech industry is worth about $65 billion to India. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. All right, it's time now for Super Bowl 51, the championship of American-style professional football. In Houston, Texas today, the Atlanta Falcons line up against the New England Patriots in a contest that will be viewed in the United States by about 150 million people, or half of the nation's population, and by many millions more around the world. It's an exciting day, as VOA's Arash Arabasadi tells me from the stadium just a short time ago by phone.
It's a party in the streets for the past few days, and now the party has pretty much kind of wrapped up the area surrounding NRG Stadium in Houston that's hosting the game. It looks like people bought their tickets probably months in advance, so there's a lot of fans of other teams wearing their home team jersey. But, of course, you've got plenty of New England Patriots fans and plenty of Atlanta Falcons fans. It's a pretty fun sight to see.
You're watching the Super Bowl in one of the biggest NFL stadiums, plus it has a roof on it, so I'm sure it's going to be quite loud there.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we haven't gone in yet. We're still kind of – there's a lot of big activity going on outside. There's a what's called the fan experience, which is basically a lot of food trucks and obviously drink tents and live music. And then right now we're over the NFL tailgate experience, which in the United States, tailgating kind of, as you know, is this big pre-party before people go into a big game. So they're out here with their cars and their trucks and they're barbecuing and they're sharing beers with total strangers. It's a fun street party atmosphere.
Okay, Arash. Have a fun time.
Anytime, man.
All right, man.
I appreciate you. Take care.
As they have fun at the stadium, the NFL's gained a foothold in China, where fans will be watching on mobile phones and tablets on their way to work because of the time difference. And for the first time, the Super Bowl will stream live on the popular social media platform Weibo. Chris Parsons is the former head of the NFL International. He tells me about the challenges and successes of bringing a unique American sport to Asia and learning from other U.S. sports, to like the National Basketball Association.
We've been very pleased as to how we've sort of been able to progress and really sort of incrementally build our fan base year after year. And so, you know, we've structured our business and our opportunity in order to sort of grow at that rate and with that sort of correct level of patients. So, we're very happy with the progress and the fans that we're developing in China.
The league obviously is so big in the United States, and there's so much underneath the NFL to support it. You have high school football, college football, and then, of course, the professional level. How difficult is it to go into a market like China, which doesn't have all of that underneath the league?
No, it definitely makes it difficult when there's no sort of grassroots infrastructure for the sport. Now, having said that, it also is an opportunity. So we've seen that specifically in China, that we've been able to put our own grassroots programs into place and seen tremendous traction with universities, with the flag football version of the game. We've started to see participation rise.
And I guess the explosion of technology has helped as well. More and more people have access to the Internet, smartphones, and can be able to get the NFL in those ways, too.
We don't now 100% have to rely on broadcasters to cover the games, particularly when you're starting off. And we can go direct to the fans with our digital products. And one example of how that's going to really drive the growth of the NFL and drive the consumption of the sport over the coming years.
Well, there are about 1.5 million people in China watching live NFL matchups now each week on digital platforms. Well, this game will help New England seeking its fifth Super Bowl championship, Atlanta making its second appearance, looking to win its first NFL title. Let us know who you think will win, and let us know on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Our winning team is director Tracy Carter, engineer Keith Holmes, and our managing editor Diane Gao. Of course, our VOA Asia team includes Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, and Eli Zimmerman. You can follow us any time of the day or night on Facebook at VOA Asia and also at voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the fundraising and support network of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. In pursuit of that goal, on January 10, 2017, the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated four individuals as specially designated global terrorists, pursuant to Executive Order 13224, which targets terrorists and those providing support to terrorists or acts of terrorism. The individuals designated include ISIL members based in Iraq, Syria, and Indonesia who are involved in ISIL's propaganda, recruitment, and support networks in Southeast Asia and Australia. As a result of OFAC's actions, all property and interests in property of these individuals subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with them. The first designee is Neil Christopher Prakash, who was named for acting for or on behalf of ISIL. He served as ISIL's most senior Australian recruiter and encouraged others to travel to Syria and Iraq to join ISIL. As of June 2015, Prakash was publicly identified as a top ISIL recruiter who facilitated the travel of new recruits, appeared in high-profile ISIL recruitment videos, and was named in a list of key contacts for aspiring ISIL foreign fighters. Khalid Sharouf is a Syria and Iraq-based ISIL member who has been involved in distributing propaganda and carrying out executions on behalf of ISIL. Barumsia Menor Usman is an ISIL official who commands ISIL fighters, facilitates funding for ISIL operations in Indonesia, recruits for ISIL, and coordinates travel and communications for ISIL members. Oman Rahman was designated for acting for or on behalf of ISIL in the areas of recruitment and media dissemination, and as of late 2015 was considered to be the de facto leader for all ISIL supporters in Indonesia, despite his incarceration in Indonesia since December 2010. These designations aim to cut off ISIL's access to the international financial system and support the global coalition's efforts to disrupt ISIL's finances and defeat the terrorist group. As ISIL seeks to recruit individuals around the world, the U.S. government will continue to target its enablers wherever they may be.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.